Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Today, I'm going to talk about a subject that it was quite interesting to Darwin, about which he had strong views that he wrote about in The Descent of Man, as I'll mention in a few moments, and about which our notions of the evolution have changed dramatically over the last few hundred years. This is just part of the work that I've done on the evolution of skin and a topic that warrants a tremendous amount more attention than it has received from biologists and anthropologists over the years. As I mentioned in an afternoon seminar, the whole study of the evolution of skin has been ignored for two reasons. Firstly, the absence of a fossil record has put a lot of people off. Secondly, the fact that skin is such a part of our social, such an intimate part of our social relationships, and people are very sensitive to the appearance of skin, whether it be skin color or skin texture or wrinkles. People are actually socially quite reserved about engaging in the study of skin. But I think we now live in, I hope, a more illumined time during which we can approach these studies in a much more dispassionate and broadly comparative and extremely constructive way. So without further ado, let's look at the evolution of skin, skin pigmentation. Darwin was born a very lightly pigmented baby in a moderately to darkly pigmented world of humans. And he was a very interesting young man. Many of you know he had quite a privileged upbringing. But early in his life, he had the ability to travel widely and see a wide variety of human phenotypes. He, of course, knew from his stays in the Natural History Library in Edinburgh and at the University of Cambridge that people did come in many shapes and sizes and colors, but it wasn't until he undertook the voyage of the Beagle, beginning when he was age 22, that he was able to fully appreciate the diversity of humanity right up close. And many of you know the details of Darwin's voyage, a very long, nearly five-year voyage that took him through a marvelous series of landforms and everything that covered those landforms, including amazing varieties of peoples and their cultures. And he encountered people of many different hues of skin tone. And he and others, actually many other human geographers and explorers for over 200 years, contributed over time to the assembling of basic maps of the distribution of skin color, such as this one published by the Italian geographer Biasutti in the early 1950s. Now, I'm sorry, for those of you who are in the back, you may not be able to see all the details clearly, but the general pattern shown in Biasutti's map and others is clear, that here at the equator, we find the most darkly pigmented people in the world, here clustered, shown in dark colors and dark vertical hachure. This pattern is strongest, dark pigmentation at the equator, lighter pigmentation toward the poles. This pattern is strongest in the old world. It exists, but it is less marked in the new world. So this pattern, which was noted by Darwin, noted by other scholars of the 19th and early 20th century, certainly begged an explanation related to environmental factors, especially something related to solar radiation. Interestingly, when Darwin did broach this subject himself, he said, of all the differences between the races of man, the color of the skin is the most conspicuous and the best marked. It was formerly thought the differences of this kind could be accounted for by long exposure to different climates, this view has been rejected chiefly because of the distribution of variously colored races, most of whom must have long inhabited their present homes, does not coincide with differences of climate. Very curious. Here was Darwin, who appreciated the geographic distribution, the clinal distribution of human skin pigmentation, and yet here clearly appealing to a different authority, actually to a series of early anthropologists, rejected the idea that skin pigmentation was related to differences of climate. As you know, if you've read Descent of Man and some of other Darwin's works, you know that he championed the idea that differences in human skin pigmentation were due primarily to sexual selection, the preference of one particular sex for mates of a particular color. In most cases, more darkly pigmented males favoring more lightly pigmented females. Well, it's too bad that Darwin didn't have access to the environmental data that we have now, because I think his views on this subject would probably be quite different. And so here, if we think about Darwin meeting NASA and having access to the same databases that we have in our work, then we can see where this illumination of Darwin's mind might come from. This map, and give full credit here to my husband and co-worker on the skin pigmentation work, George Chaplin. George was able to read a very large NASA data set over 13 million data points representing readings taken by the NASA TOMS satellite, which measures total ultraviolet radiation, I should say ultraviolet radiation in the most biologically active wavelengths for humans at the Earth's surface. This is a map of annual average UV radiation at the Earth's surface. And what you can see, I hope you can discern this from the back, continental outlines here of South America, North America, Africa, and here's Australia, there's Antarctica. The hot red and pink areas show the highest amount of UV on an annual basis. Quite predictably, the highest levels of ultraviolet radiation here near the equator, but not in a straight latitudinal band. There's a lot of variation according to the amount of cloud cover and moisture in the atmosphere, so that the moisture areas, for instance, here in equatorial Amazonia, have lower UV levels than the drier areas. Here, dry sub-Saharan Africa, very, very high UV levels. Moister parts of equatorial Africa, significantly lower. So many of these, at all latitudes, we have some heterogeneity, but there's certainly the pattern of high UV at the equator and lower UV at the poles. This, you will notice, is very interestingly biased against, well, I should say there's a difference in the UV coverage of the northern versus the southern hemisphere. We'll come back to this shortly, but there's a very great bias here in the northern hemisphere with the largest land masses, and here I reference Eurasia especially, this huge land mass being in an area of generally very low annual UV. Also a large fraction of North America in the same condition, whereas here in the southern hemisphere, most of the land mass, and here I'm referencing the major body of South America and much of equatorial Africa, is centered in areas of high UV. So there is an inherent bias, a difference between the northern and the southern hemisphere in the distribution of land mass and where that falls in ultraviolet radiation. This pattern has had dramatic ramifications for our understanding of the evolution of skin pigmentation. Now, let's imagine that we are here at the either the vernal or the autumnal equinox at the equator, and let's look exactly at what's happening to ultraviolet radiation. Ultraviolet radiation comes in several different categories of wavelengths. Ultraviolet C radiation is the most highly energetic and is completely absorbed, or more or less completely absorbed, except in a few parts of the atmosphere, by atmospheric ozone and oxygen. UVC is the most destructive of the UV species, but basically doesn't factor into life on Earth because the ozone and atmospheric oxygen content of the atmosphere screen it out entirely. Only at the ozone hole in the southern hemisphere do we find appreciable amounts of UVC penetrating the Earth's surface. UVB, which will figure largely in our discussion tonight, is significantly attenuated as it passes through the atmosphere here. Notice that sun's rays coming from the sun onto the equator at either one of the equinoxes pass directly through the atmosphere, and they don't pass obliquely. So even though UV is attenuated, you still get this UVB species coming in fairly high concentrations, and UVA, the least energetic of the types of UV, comes virtually unimpeded through this pack of atmosphere, so that you have extremely high loads of both UVA and UVB. Now, I go into this because each one of these types of ultraviolet radiation has specific activity on humans. UVB, the more energetic of the two that reach the Earth's surface, penetrates human skin just a little bit more than, well, on average, less than 1 millimeter. And it penetrates the very superficial layer and it penetrates the epidermis and just into the superficial part of the dermis of the skin. UVB is mostly a very malign entity. It does all sorts of bad things to biological systems, as does all of UV in general. It causes direct and indirect damage to DNA. It generates a lot of free radicals, so-called, because they can have deleterious effects on a variety of different reactions in biological systems. UVB disrupts cell membranes. It does a whole host of really fairly terrible things. Ultraviolet radiation in general has been one of the most creative forces in the evolution of life on Earth, simply because it's such a deleterious entity that biological systems have had to adapt and find mechanisms to protect themselves from the deleterious effects of ultraviolet radiation. The one good thing that ultraviolet B radiation does is it begins the process of making vitamin D in human skin and in the skin of all other terrestrial vertebrates. So it's basically a malign entity, but this one function, the beginning of the process of making vitamin D in the skin, turns out to be remarkably important. UVA, of which there is a lot falling on the Earth's surface at the equator. There's huge amounts, but even at our latitudes here in Los Angeles throughout the year, you have a surfeit of UVA. And even if you went to Seattle in the middle of the winter, you would still have quite a bit of UVA as part of the total solar insulation at that latitude. So UVA is able to transit through the atmosphere, and you get a lot of it, and it penetrates very deeply into the skin, able to have deleterious effects on DNA, just like UVB, but also it penetrates deeply and damages the connective tissues in the dermis of skin. Hence, the reason your dermatologist is telling you, please wear protective clothing, don't just wear sunscreen, to protect you from UVA that damages collagen and elastin and causes long-term wrinkling problems to long-lived primates like ourselves. Now, one of the one of the very key players in this saga of the evolution of skin pigmentation is the primary pigment in human skin, which is melanin. There are lots of different pigments in biological systems, but melanin is probably the most ubiquitous of the pigments used in plants and some fungi more than angiosperm and gymnosperm plants, but a variety of invertebrates and vertebrates. Melanin is one of these molecules that is just, it should be celebrated in some kind of great evolutionary fest because it is used over and over and over again in evolution. When you hit upon something that works, you use it again and again, and you tinker with it very, very little. Melanin is one of these molecules that has been tinkered with very little because it works so well at absorbing and scattering ultraviolet radiation and basically chemically neutralizing the free radicals caused by ultraviolet radiation and ionizing radiation. So it has been recruited over and over and over again as a natural sunscreen. Melanin is the pigment that imparts most of the color to human skin and the skin of other vertebrates around us. When you look at a dog's nose, when you look at the color of most fish, their coloration is brought about by different types of melanin. And basically, everything from lizards to chickens to all forms of mammals are colored by different forms of melanin. And the key properties of the key sunscreening properties are critical in understanding why some people in the world have a lot of melanin and some people have less. One of the things that we realized as we uncovered the history, or as we looked into the history of human skin and skin pigmentation, was that as humans evolved functionally naked skin, probably 1.5 to 2 million years ago, that it was necessary for them to have some other means of protecting themselves against the deleterious effects of ultraviolet radiation. When you think about hair on the surface of the body, and you can think about our closest relative, a chimpanzee, or you can think about your dog or your cat, the hair on the surface of the animal's body protects them from a variety of external agents, including ultraviolet radiation. Hair is a very good natural sunscreen. If you remove the hair, and we have every reason to believe, for a variety of reasons that I won't go into right now, that humans evolved functionally naked skin as an integral part of their evolution to a more active lifestyle in equatorial environments, then you have to meet the challenge of protecting the body with something other than hair. And so what happens is that melanin, which is present in the melanin-producing cells, which are present in the skin of all primates, become permanently turned on in our ancestors. The evolution of darkly pigmented skin in the early members of the genus Homo, evolving in equatorial Africa, was extremely important. And we have circumstantial evidence from levels of activity in fossil hominins. We know that these were active, striding, running, bipedal people with functionally naked skin, very sweaty skin. They would have needed some protection against the sun. The protection was melanin. And we also know from recent studies looking at the genes controlling pigmentation that one of the main genes controlling pigmentation is present in an invariant form in modern African populations. In other words, in the terminology of geneticists, it has undergone purifying selection so that there are no variations in this gene.
this particular morphology, functionally hairless skin that is darkly pigmented, is the ancestral morphology for our Homo lineage, more or less for the last 2 million years. And all of the derivations that we see of moderate to lightly pigmented skin started out really from this phenotype. And this is, I think, a very, very important revelation. Now, darkly pigmented skin works extremely well under high UV regimes. As I said, it is a natural sunscreen. Well, what is it protecting you against? What exactly does ultraviolet radiation do that makes it so bad for humans? We know that it's generally bad to biological systems, but when we talk about any attribute being an adaptation in biology, we ultimately have to come back to Darwin's arbiter, reproductive success. What appearance, what phenotype of an organism is going to conduce to an organism's reproductive success? What is going to enhance its natural selection? Well, one of the key things about melanin is it not only protects against the damage to DNA in skin cells, it also prevents or greatly slows the breakdown of a very important molecule, a vitamin called folate. And our theory of the evolution of human skin pigmentation draws heavily on the fact that folate, which is one of the B vitamin group present in green vegetables and citrus fruits and whole grains and so forth, we have to eat it, we can't manufacture it. Folate is UV sensitive, and moderate to high levels of ultraviolet A radiation break down folate very, very quickly. What do you do if you require folate for various physiological processes and you need to protect it? Well, you could increase something that your body already has the ability to produce, the natural sunscreen melanin. So now, why is folate in particular important? Folate is important because it provides, well, it is one of the basic building blocks of the of the bases in DNA. As you know, DNA is a double helical model made of purine and pyrimidine bases, and DNA synthesis depends on folate for the manufacture of these bases. So you can imagine, if you can't produce DNA, you can't have any cell division. And so any process requiring a lot of cell division in the body is going to be subject very much to fluctuations in folate availability. The central insight that led to our work on the evolution of skin pigmentation actually came from research, epidemiological research, done over 20 years ago, looking at the relationship between folate deficiencies and a class of birth defects called neural tube defects. It turns out, here's you at 21 days, okay? Unrecognizable as a proto-human, but as a tiny embryo, basically the human embryonic disc forms the primordium of your nervous system on the dorsal surface at three weeks of pregnancy, before most women know they're pregnant. The process of formation of the early brain and spinal cord is done through a finely choreographed process of cell division and then fusion of layers of cells from one side to another, forming this neural tube, which will ultimately form the brain at one end and the spinal cord in the rest of the length of the embryo. This basic morphogenesis process occurs over the space of just 4 to 5 days and is precisely timed. It requires prodigious amounts of cell division. What happens if you don't have enough folate? Predictably, this process can be interrupted in a big way or in a small way, leading to either a major birth defect completely incompatible with life or a less significant one. Many of you have probably heard of at least one type of neural tube defect because spina bifida is well known and is often, that term is also often used to refer to this whole class of defects that can occur. So when we think about natural selection, an environmental agent affecting reproductive success, here is seemingly a very good example. Ultraviolet radiation, specifically ultraviolet A radiation, destroying folate, which is essential for folate synthesis, which is essential for DNA synthesis. In other words, if you can interject a natural sunscreen into this process, you can protect this entire reproductive mechanism. And so we hypothesized several years ago that dark pigmentation evolved in equatorial peoples and became fixed as a phenotype, as an appearance in our equatorial African ancestors because primarily of this mechanism, the importance of maintaining the integrity of this mechanism. It also happens that you need folate for producing DNA for all sorts of other purposes of cell proliferation in your body. Right now, you're using folate to make lots of DNA in various cells, including males making new sperm cells. So if you have serious depletion of folate as a male, you can considerably and negatively impact your sperm production. So we have then half of the story. Dark pigmentation evolved in our earliest ancestors of the genus Homo, evolving in equatorial Africa, primarily to protect the folate mechanism and DNA synthesis and cell division. Great. But of course, humans didn't stay put. We know that the first out of Africa dispersal occurred 1.8 to 1.9 million years ago, and that humans dispersed from their nascent homeland in eastern equatorial Africa into Southeast Asia. We find some of the earliest fossils in Java. We also have fossils here in former Soviet Georgia at 1.8 and 1.7 million years ago. So We know that humans spread quickly, and what happens as humans spread into non-tropical latitudes? We know from our UV map that here humans are rapidly dispersing into areas that have very different ultraviolet radiation regimes. What happened to the people as they ventured into these climes? Well, let's look at ultraviolet radiation levels. If we imagine that we're somewhere in the northern hemisphere now instead of at the equator, and here winter solstice. Let's look at the same ultraviolet pattern. Here we have ultraviolet C, again being completely absorbed by the atmosphere. Ultraviolet B, because it's a high-energy species, here it's transiting this thick pack of atmospheric ozone and oxygen, and it completely peters out. No ultraviolet B makes it to northern latitudes or far southern latitudes in the austral winter at all. So what does that mean? It means that there's no potential for making vitamin D during much of the year at extreme northern latitudes, and that the amount of UVB is greatly reduced during much of the year. UVA still passes relatively unimpeded through this thick pack of atmosphere, and so UVA loads, even at high latitudes, are still quite high. But the UVB profile is very different, and this difference turns out to be critical. UVB is necessary for the initiation of production of vitamin D in human skin and in the skin of other terrestrial vertebrate animals. And so if you don't have enough UVB, then you have some real biological issues to contend with. Also, if you have a lot of natural sunscreen in your body and you're dispersing into a latitude where there's not very much UVB, all of a sudden, the previously positive attribute, dark pigmentation, which was protecting you from high UV loads at the equator, now becomes an attribute that is no longer positive. It is actually deleterious under new environmental circumstances. So what was good in one place isn't necessarily good in another. And this is exactly what early humans, part of that early first out of Africa dispersal, as well as humans in the second out of Africa dispersal, experienced. They dispersed into lower UV regimes, and the melanin, the natural sunscreen in their skin, which was so wonderful and protective, all of a sudden turns out to work against them, because high levels of melanin in the skin so attenuate UVB that it takes much longer to produce vitamin D. If you stand outside, if I or somebody with even lighter pigmentation stands outside today in UCLA next to someone with much more darkly pigmented skin, the person with very lightly pigmented skin basking in a moderate amount of UVB that we would be receiving at the Earth's surface today here at this location, a very lightly pigmented person would be able to synthesize quite a bit of vitamin D in unprotected skin within 10 to 15 minutes. The darkly pigmented person would have to stand in the same position for an hour and a half to produce the same amount of vitamin D. So effective is melanin as a natural sunscreen against UVB. So if you move as a person into a latitude with lower levels of UVB, even than Los Angeles, far north, northern America, or northern parts of Eurasia, you can see immediately the problem. So here we have very high levels of UV at the equator, lower levels as we get toward the poles, and holy moly, here we have early human populations dispersing out of Africa, going along coastal routes here into Southeast Asia. Okay, moderate levels of UV, not too low, but as soon as they start dispersing into higher latitudes, in the first out of Africa event and the second out of Africa event, we see people trespassing into extremely low UV environments. This is the landscape for natural selection, for positive selection, for loss of pigmentation. If you have darkly pigmented skin, like the most darkly pigmented African or Melanesian or Australian people, the areas, these polygons shown on this map, are the only safe areas, completely safe areas, where you can have very darkly pigmented skin and still make enough vitamin D in your body over the course of the year to have optimal health. If you have darkly pigmented skin, very darkly pigmented skin, and you live outside of these areas, you almost certainly will have some level of vitamin D deficiency unless you supplement your diet with vitamin D, or in an evolutionary context, if you lose pigment in your skin. So this is a very, very telling map. There are relatively few safe environments on the Earth's surface if you have high levels of pigmentation in your skin where you can maintain a proper amount of vitamin D in your body to maintain optimal health. Now, vitamin D is far more important, or we're recognizing it, that it's far more important to our physiology than I think was ever appreciated even a decade ago. People have known for a long time that vitamin D is necessary to build a strong skeleton, to maintain a strong skeleton, because it facilitates calcium absorption from the gut. But we now know that in addition to growth and maintenance of bone, that vitamin D is incredibly important in maintaining a strong immune system. And so probably much of the morbidity that we associate with wintertime colds and flus and other ailments could be due ultimately to vitamin D insufficiency or deficiency causing the a down regulation of immune system function. The most notorious examples of vitamin D deficiency, however, are manifested as the disease called rickets. And nutritional rickets is not just a disease of Western Industrial Revolution times. It has been common under conditions in Northern Europe. Also, it's increasingly common today in equatorial Africa among children raised inside and not given enough sun exposure and or enough calcium in their diet. Rickets is a serious problem because it not only is disfiguring and causes lots of problems in locomotion, but in females, the pelvic deformity caused by rickets basically precludes childbirth. This very flattened pelvic opening precludes normal childbirth and is a very, very strong selective agent. So that females who have marked cases of nutritional rickets cannot have a normal birth. One of the interesting sidelights of this is that in the history of the United States, obstetric surgery developed very, very strongly in the days just before and after the Civil War, when many cesarean sections had to be performed on African American slave women who had very pronounced cases of nutritional rickets. So a lot of our modern cesarean section technology was actually developed on African American slave women who had suffered from nutritional rickets. Anyway, that's beside the point. Suffice it to say that if these women had not had a cesarean section, they would not have been able to deliver a child. And this severe nutritional rickets appearance would have been a very, very strong selective agent. Again, here is a case of the scimitar of natural selection falling very strongly. If you have insufficient vitamin D, you cannot have a healthy immune system or a strong skeleton that can support a normal childbirth. So here we have a tremendous impetus, as it were, for the evolution of loss of pigment. And I'm not a geneticist. I study the evolution of phenotypes, but I've been fascinated by the fact that we have been able, and the royal we here, the we as scientists, have been able to illuminate at least three instances in human evolutionary history at which depigmentation occurred. Two of these involved our own modern species, Homo sapiens. And in the second out of Africa event, we now know that modern humans radiating into northern and northwestern Europe underwent loss of pigmentation. There have been some wonderful papers looking at the particular genes that contribute to this loss of pigmentation. And the loss of pigmentation in Northern and Western Europe occurred independently of that experienced by human populations moving into Eastern Asia and Northeastern Asia. So both of these populations underwent genetic changes under strong natural selection, but they were different genetic changes. in terms of the microscopic scrutiny of evolution, it is the appearance of the organism, the phenotype, that really counts here. It's not the genes that contribute to it. Is does this appearance of the organism work under a particular set of environmental parameters? If it does, right, we'll go for it. And so we see a variety of different molecular means to the same end of appearance, and in this case, loss of pigment. Significantly and fascinating, we had many years ago predicted that any population, any human population dispersing into high latitudes would have had to have undergone depigmentation in order to maintain vitamin D production in their skin under low conditions of ultraviolet B. We predicted that this would have obtained not only with Homo sapiens, but with previous human dispersals into high latitudes. Now, what's the most famous example of that? The Neanderthals, of course, these descendants of Homo erectus, ultimately descendants of the first out of Africa event that populated the circum-Mediterranean beginning around 200,000 years ago, a very successful lineage that appears to have died out completely. But during the course of Homo neanderthalensis evolution, they invaded biomes as far north as northern Germany and southern England. And as we now know from a very ingenious study that was carried out by some researchers a few years ago, they also have in their DNA the signature of natural selection acting on their genes to bring about loss of pigmentation. Neanderthals are one of the few groups of ancient extinct organisms from which we've been able to salvage small pieces of DNA, amplify the DNA, and look at the DNA sequence to compare it to modern humans. And what was fascinating in the study that I'm referring to is that they were able to discover from these ancient DNA fragments in Neanderthals that the pigmentation gene in Neanderthals would have expressed itself in a way that would have led to light skin and probably red hair in at least some percentage. They estimated about 10% of the population. So a very, very interesting reconstruction of ancient gene function done quite recently. And forcing our paleontologically based and physiologically based hypothesis about depigmentation would have had to have occurred. So we're now encouraging other genetic research groups to look at the evolution of deeply pigmented skin, because we would hypothesize that not only did depigmented skin evolve more than once as humans dispersed into high latitudes, but the deeply pigmented skin may have evolved more than once as human groups dispersed into areas of low UV and then redispersed into areas with high UV. Such as this particular, this southern Indian person and her infant. Here, peoples living in southern India. India is a very complex, demographically population complex place that has many populations probably derived from an original coastal colonization, as well as populations that evolved in northern India or outside of India in Central Asia and then dispersed into peninsular India over the last 20,000 years. This woman represents one of the latter, but she is very, very darkly pigmented. Her ancestors coming from the foothills of the Himalayas or slightly farther west would not have been as darkly pigmented as this. And so we are hypothesizing that in this population and possibly others that have invaded, as it were, high UV environments, that we would see a new positive selection for regaining permanent pigmentation in the skin. So I await further genetic tests of this. I think this is a fascinating issue. So what we can see is that human skin pigmentation is clearly the product of natural selection. And what we have as we look at this map of predicted human skin pigmentation is a series of two clines or gradients. We have a gradient that starts at the equator that emphasizes protection against high UV radiation, and then we have a cline that is most marked at the extremities of the poles that emphasizes loss of pigmentation and facilitation, the utmost facilitation of DNA production through depigmentation. Also, what we know about people inhabiting these very northern climes is that they not only have to have maximally depigmented skin, they have to eat a lot of vitamin D-rich foods in order to be able to survive at these latitudes, because even during the summer months, they can't produce enough vitamin D in their bodies to get them through the rest of the year. So they have to have vitamin D-rich diets, such as marine mammals, oily fish, and so forth. So many of these Aboriginal peoples have diets that are centered around such foodstuffs. What happens to all of these folks sort of in the middle? Well, we have people broadly in the circum-Mediterranean latitudes that have a variable appearance, the ability to make pigment prodigiously in some cases in response to ultraviolet radiation. We call this, anthropologists and zoologists call this acquisition of facultative pigmentation, you call it tanning. Okay? Some people have a tremendous ability to tan, and if your ancestors are from these middle latitudes outside of the tropics, but basically south of about 40 degrees latitude, you have an ability to develop pigment in your skin under seasonal regimes of sun. And this evolution of tanning, a flexible appearance, a flexible phenotype, is extremely important in human evolution. So what is so interesting about skin color when we think about concepts of race is that if you've got an attribute like skin color that can sort of come and go, that is highly labile and subjected to natural selection, what good is it as a marker of unique genetic ancestry? It's not. The fact that it comes and goes so much, you can lose pigment multiple times, you've probably gained pigment multiple times, so the possession of any particular level of skin pigmentation, it tells you a lot about evolutionary processes. It tells you a lot about the solar regimes under which your ancestors evolved, but it doesn't tell you anything about genetic uniqueness in itself. It simply signifies the environment in which your ancestors lived. So we have some interesting cases here. I just want to take you through a few interesting case studies. The Sami people living in northern Finland, some of them live on the coast and have high levels of vitamin D-rich fish in their diet. The hinterland Sami, how do they make a living? How do they have maximally depigmented skin, but where do they get the rest of their vitamin D from? Fascinating, they eat reindeer that eat lichen that are high in vitamin D2. The reindeer convert the vitamin D2 into vitamin D3, which humans then eat and utilize. So if Sami people stop eating reindeer, they have vitamin D deficiencies. Many people ask me, oh my goodness, your theory must be wrong because Inuit people, Eskimos, have darkly pigmented skin. They live at these very high latitudes. What's going on with them? Inuit people have tremendous abilities to develop pigment in relation to ultraviolet radiation exposure. And what kind of ultraviolet radiation do they get there? They get tremendous amounts of UVA reflected off of the surface of snow and ice. So here is a fantastic example of human cultural and biological adaptation working together. Here, the Inuit people have probably lived at these latitudes for no more than 12 or maybe 13,000 years, and they have evolved a heightened ability to tan on their exposed parts of skin to deal with these high UVA levels reflected off of snow and ice. How do they compensate? Because their tan effectively precludes any UVB absorption by their skin. They compensate by having a diet, at least originally, that was based solely on the exploitation of marine mammals with some fish. So you have walruses, sea lions, whales, and so forth, extremely high vitamin D-rich foods as the core resource on which they depend. So a very, very interesting anthropological example of biology and culture coming to a happy compromise. Now, humans have been on the move voluntarily for thousands of years. We have humans moving within Africa in the Bantu, in the expansion of the Bantu language speakers. We've got humans in historical times moving all over the world. What's been happening, especially in the last 500 years, is people moving longer distances faster. And so we see these huge distances being traversed very, very quickly. And all of a sudden, we have folks who are sort of out of sync with their ancestral environments, out of sync with respect to skin pigmentation, phenotype, and levels of solar radiation, especially ultraviolet radiation, in their new areas of habitation. And so we have people with lightly pigmented skin living in Southern California, and other folks, this is, you know, your dermatologist, I'm sure many of you have been to dermatologists and have been treated for various of these things. We suffer living Europeans suffer from living at latitudes that they're not accustomed to, and the solar radiation at those latitudes. We suffer by having cumulative damage to DNA as well as short-term damage to levels of folate. And one of the most serious effects, of course, is that melanomas are now on the increase, caused by high-intensity short periods of UVA radiation, mostly UVA. And, of course, exacerbated by certain cultural phenomena like tanning and going to tanning salons and so forth, cultural behaviors that are certainly not part of our original human evolutionary landscape. So we have other problems with darkly pigmented people who then go to live in areas with low UV regimes, very different from those that they experienced here in the subcontinent of India or in equatorial Africa. What happens to them, of course, is that many of them suffer from nutritional rickets and other bone diseases, and sometimes these problems are exacerbated by the wearing of extensive protective clothing, so that you have not only problems with darkly pigmented skin, people living at high latitudes and having low levels of UVB, but when they stay inside and wear high levels of protective clothing, we have a recipe for physiological disaster, and lots of females and their children are suffering from bone diseases and a host of immune system compromises as a result of having insufficient levels of vitamin D. Big public health remediation campaigns in Northern Europe have been underway for more than 20 years, just now catching on in the United States. Of course, many populations in the history of humanity didn't move voluntarily. The transatlantic slave trade involved over 13 million people involuntarily moving from equatorial Africa into locations very far removed from equatorial Africa, and in terms of solar environment, often very far removed here in Western Europe and certainly in Northeastern America. So many humans were involved in this trade over about 350-year history of the major slave trade. So how much more significant is it that now we have a moderately pigmented person of half African ancestry in a position of power? Significant because darkly pigmented people have suffered so long through a series of social injustices caused by the fact that they had contact with lightly pigmented people who were not in an equal power situation with them. So they suffered inordinately as a result primarily of the African slave trade, but not exclusively as a result of that, with darkly pigmented people often cast in benighted positions for centuries and suffering tremendous social injustices. We are now in a position, I think, as a result of our scientific knowledge and also having leadership that is physically distinguishable as moderately pigmented, to be able to move beyond this benighted past. President Obama has moderate levels of skin pigmentation characteristic of admixed populations, as well as those peoples living in moderate latitudes that have a great potential for facultative pigmentation. But I think Obama, like other people with his same pigmentation levels, will run a tremendous risk of vitamin D insufficiency and deficiency because his desk job is going to preclude him from taking in very much sun in Hawaii or elsewhere. So he will have to watch his vitamin D levels, among many other things that he'll have to be alert to. So I think I wish to conclude by saying just a few things. Firstly, I think we can say conclusively that human skin pigmentation is a good Darwinian adaptation. It is a product of natural selection. And this is really a wonderful statement for several reasons. One of my favorite reasons is that this provides an unparalleled and unmatched opportunity for those of us who are science educators to be able to educate our children, our relatives, our friends, our students about the evolution, about the action of evolution. Because now one can simply cite their own skin as a product of evolution. You don't have to think about, oh, experiments with Drosophila, or let's look for this fossil, or whatever. You can talk about your skin as a product of evolution by natural selection. A portable teaching device. You've got it. Use it. It's really important. The fact that we can demonstrate this, that we can easily talk about it, that it's readily understandable, that young people are interested in it, fantastic. Teach it. Learn about it. It's just extremely important. And also, the knowledge, I'm a perennial optimist, and I feel that the more that we know about the background, the evolutionary history of human variation, the less pejorative will be our discussions about discrimination due to variation in human pigmentation and other types of variation. In other words, that knowledge and education, particularly at early stages in our own ontogeny, can have a real positive effect on us. Skin pigmentation is an evolutionarily fascinating attribute. What a wonderful thing to celebrate, and what a wonderful way for us to think about the evolution of human variation. If we can bring this framework into our discussions and just into our educational system, I think it will have unmatched and really unforeseen positive benefits. And I would like to end on that note of celebrating the variation that we see in this room, talking about it to one another in the framework of evolution, as Darwin, I think, would have loved it were he here. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.